I'm like, I'm gonna finish the book. And I'm like wild-eyed, you know, and hopped up on coffee and no sleep. And that was some good writing, you know, on caffeine and no sleep, man. But I did it.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed, not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. Former youth pastor Marlia Cochran wanted to write the perfect book about other people's stories of disillusionment, but there was another plan afoot. Plan for addressing her own disillusionment and for healing and restoration that would begin with her beliefs about God and herself and eventually ripple into every other area of her life. Tune in to find out how Marlia insisted on telling other stories until she witnessed a divine connection that she just could not ignore. You'll find out how months of deep loss ensued before she realized it was playing a key part in her writing process. You'll hear the story of how she discovered and rewrote a core belief that was ruining her relationship with her father and setting the next generation up for more disillusionment and pain. And finally, you'll see how we all witnessed the restoration of every loss that led her to writing a book in the first place. It's about that time. Grab a cup of something yummy and enjoy these sips of story insanity with us.
So real talk, just before we get started, I have to tell you that I'm wearing business on the top and I've got like sweats on the bottom because that's my life right now. And the back of my hair is not even curled and I've got it clipped so it doesn't show up. And the back of my shirt isn't ironed either. So that just tells you where I'm at in life. And I want to be real. I want to show up real. But sometimes you got to put a little, you know, paint on the barn. So, and that's where I feel like I'm at. So I, you know, cause the story's messy and, it just always stays messy.
It does. All right. Well,
okay. Now we can go.
On that note, welcome to Sips of Story Insanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories, the real stuff, the messy stuff with authors, speakers, thought leaders, healers, parents, and more. My team, Erin.
Hello.
Sister Alyssa.
Hey, everyone.
And clients turned friends turned team members, Teddy.
Hi, y'all.
And Lori.
Hey, everyone.
They're here to help me make sure that we get the most delicious sips of story insanity out of this conversation with Marlia Cochran.
Hello. Who
has already introduced herself so beautifully. I think, thank you for setting the stage. Like that. I mean, here's how she is on paper. Marlia Cochran is a pastor, transformational speaker, author, and recovering perfectionist. She received her BA in Christian ministry with a minor in psychology and an MA in pastoral studies with a youth ministry emphasis. Marlia currently resides in Southern California, where she serves as associate pastor in Covina and lives with her best friend and husband, Josh, their three kids, and their dog, Reese Joy. So cute. She loves spending time with her family, watching a good movie, and laminating her stresses away, which we are going to talk about. Welcome, yeah. Marlia.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you guys.
I before we start, I just feel like I have to point out how many recovering perfectionists have we had on this podcast so far? right? Yes. I feel like that's a theme.
Erin, you know, when we're talking about business and we're talking about avatars like target market and people who will best be suited for this work, that's
number one.
That's a thread. It's in the top five of characteristics of people who naturally tend to gravitate to this work. Because why, Marlia? Why do we gravitate towards this work when we're such perfectionists? Like, why wouldn't we just run the hell away? Tell me.
Well, partly because we think that we're going to hold on to our perfectionism when we start this. And then, you know, because we're going to write the perfect book. And we're going to have the perfect journey and we're going to do it perfectly, perfection. And then you get into it and you realize, well, that's a hot mess. And I'm a hot mess and my story's a hot mess. And so it just all kind of starts spilling out and going everywhere. And so again, you go in with the illusion that you're going to maintain your perfection. And then you start, you know, unpacking everything and just, it's a hot mess oozing out every which way. And awesome. Then I think you start realizing that that's way more fun to live in the hot mess. And not so much that it's fun, like, ooh, let's go to Disneyland fun, but more so of like, that's real. And I'm tired of having to maintain the facade. Though I will tell you that as a recovering perfectionist, I slip back into it all the time. And so it's just a constant battle.
Yeah.
Podcast over. Fantastic. You just answered all the questions.
Then, mic drop, boom. Done.
I mean, the girl just does not have time to do long, like, just, she's figured it out. We've been doing this for 10 years. She's like, this is it. I'm in, I'm out. I'm back taking care of my wrestling children.
I got kids crying. I don't know what to do with this. So, yeah.
Well, I want to talk about the original illusion.
Yeah.
What was it? What was your dream? You were going to go change the world with this message. What was the message? How were you going to do it?
So I remember our first conversation, Janae Dana, who you've already interviewed and done a podcast with and who you wrote a book with, and she's part of the collaboration and all of this. I saw a Facebook post from her. And I had been thinking about writing a book for a couple of years. And I was telling people that I was writing a book and I had written like the same first sentence, probably 100 times. And yet I was still telling people I was writing a book and they're like, oh, how's that going for you? And I'm like, it's going great. I'm a sentence in. It's great. It's so good. And I saw a Facebook post that she had put up that she had just finished her book and we had actually worked with her. We had a previous business doing marketing and promotional and screen printing and stuff. And so we had worked with her on her her first prototype. And when she had written her Facebook post about this coach that she had worked with and that she was amazing, I immediately reached out to her and was like, okay, who is this chick? Because I need to know her, I think. And so when you and I talked the first time and you're like, oh yes, this and that and Messenger. And I was like, okay, I just got to put some stuff on a paper. And you're like, sure. Okay. And I've got this retreat. Do you want to come? And I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. And so I got there and my intention, my first thought was that I was going to tell other people's stories of disillusionment and recovery and all of these different things and going through hard circumstances and how they, you know, kind of recuperated in the spiritual aspect and in the healing aspect and all of these things. And we're halfway through this retreat and you're like, you realize you have to tell your story of all the things that you've just gone through. And I said, well, I don't know what you're thinking, but that's not it at all. I have no story. And you're like, yes, you absolutely do. And I was like, yes, but I don't want to talk about it because it's messy. And I want to tell other people's messy stories because that's way more, you know, fun for me not to delve into my own junk. And you're like, okay, sure. Let's just put some post-it notes on paper and let's just talk about this. And so by the end of the retreat, I really had come to the realization that, that God was not calling me to tell other people's stories, but that he was calling me to tell my own story because that's what I had lived and that's what I had experienced. And that's where he met me, was in my story. And so it was kind of a, you know, a shock to the system. And I had to come home and talk to my husband and go, I think that I got to put my stuff on paper And he was like, oh, good luck with that. And and so, you know, it kind of started off just me wanting to disconnect and wanting to play it safe and it be about other people. Because, you know, it's hard talking about your own stuff because you have to then process it and you have to deal with it. And sometimes that can be scary, really scary. But that's ultimately kind of where I came from, was that who's going to listen to me? Let me just talk about other people.
And so, what were you thinking as far as like, I mean, women who were disillusioned was kind of the market, but what was your vision for like, what was this going to turn into for you? Were you going to, were you a pastor at this point? Were you going to be in ministry? Like, how was this part of the plan?
So I had been a youth pastor for 10 years previously. And when I had my daughter, I stepped out of ministry because she had some medical complications. And that's what I told everybody was the reason why I stepped out of ministry, was that I need to be about the ministry of motherhood, which is noble and solid. And I absolutely commend women who actually do that. But my reason for stepping out was that I was burned out and I was tired and I could not, I couldn't function like I was functioning. And so when I went through a major health issue, where I, you know, was told I have this very rare autoimmune disease and almost died a few times and went through a massive, spiritual disillusionment, angry with God, shaking my fist. I'm sure my neighbors thought I was bat crazy because I would sit in my hot tub in my backyard and just scream at God. Because my whole thing was like, you know, I was a good girl. Like we struck this deal, whether you realize it or not, God, we struck a deal. And I was a good girl and good girls get good things. And this was not a good thing. And so I, you know, after having stepped out of ministry and we had started a business and I am wrestling with this spiritual kind of coming undone. And that's where I was in this disillusionment. And then when I went through kind of the toughest part of the physical aspects of things, and God literally met me in my hospital room, I was dying. And my husband was like, girl, you need to pray. And I was like, why am I going to pray? He doesn't listen anyway. Like, look at me over this last year. I've just fallen apart. I can't be a mom. I can't do anything. And he said, you better pray. And so I just told God, you know what? You either get me out of the bed so that I can minister for you, or just take me now because this isn't going to work anymore. And within just a very short time, God literally began healing me physically. And there was a spiritual healing that started in that moment too, because it was finally me submitting to the process that he was wanting to take me through. And it wasn't that he made me sick. That was just a genetic anomaly, but he did want to take me through a process in it of submission and seeing him differently, seeing him as my good father and not this angry, vindictive God that held our stuff over us, that, you know, was angry because I stepped out of ministry and was going to punish me forever for it. But that he was a good and gracious and loving God who had something different for me. And so when I went through that whole experience and kind of came out the other side and still was grappling with my thought process of God and having to, I don't want to use the word deconstruct because that has a whole different kind of context right now within the church realm, but in a sense, having to unravel some things that I had grown up with, some thought processes around God. And so, and one of those was disillusionment with the idea of who God was. And again, how he viewed us as his kids and me specifically as his daughter. And that's what I was bringing to the book. And that was my thought process going in, was that I wanted to speak to the women who had walked through hard life and were coming out, you know, had claimed or had lived a walk with God in a way that they were experiencing these hard things and going, God, where are you at? And this is not what it was supposed to look like. This is not what I expected. This is not what I, you know, signed up for. And so that's what I was writing, you know, who I thought I was going to be writing about. And then ultimately it was about my own story and trying to connect with those women in particular who are trying to kind of weed through the tall grass of just struggling with God and trying to come out the other side, deeper with God and yet different.
Mm-hmm. Teddy, do you remember her face when I asked her about her? Sorry.
When she was talking, I thought, no, you're leaving out a little bit of the story here. Marlia had very short spiked, was it purple hair? I think purple hair.
Pink, like tinged back. Yeah. And very striped, like very like blonde and dark and red. And
And her whole demeanor was, I've just been sitting here looking at you and watching you talk and how beautiful and soft and like the transformation is just amazing. Cause that just that look along with your like, that ain't happening. I'm not, you weren't smiling though. No. I was like, no.
I was quite
pretty. I'm here to write other people's stories. That's, but you know, that was it. You were not doing it.
No. And you know, it's interesting because like when I've looked back at the pictures of me with the really short spiky hair, Amanda and I went to go watch that movie Frozen when it first came out. And there's that one scene where, and again, you know, people are going to go, oh, that's so cheesy. But that one scene where Elsa is in the ice castle. And she starts like throwing, you know, like basically these like shards of glass or shards of ice. And it like immediately builds up this like spiky thing. That's what my hair was. Like looking back, like that was kind of the imagery in my mind that, and it was just hair, but it was this very like prickly, hard, this is my shell.
Kind of armor.
Thing. Yeah.
It was your armor.
It was armor.
Yeah, because you had done a lot. Like you had come back from the brink of death. Like you don't negotiate new contracts with God and come back from the brink of death and it means nothing. Like it meant a lot.
Yeah.
And yet you know, the fact that you were like, I'm going to tell other people's stories told me that there was still something that hadn't quite been seen or worked out or something. And even to the point of, you know, so do you have your own question, like your own story of disillusionment? You're like, yeah, the health crisis. And I was like, the health crisis, tell me about that. So you like told that story and like, everyone is like, oh my God, she almost died. Why wouldn't you tell that story? You know, like we're trying to figure it out. And then you said, you talked about the post-it thing. Tell about the post-it. Like we're working out the process of how are you going to map this book out? How are you going to figure out like the phases, like the most important defining moments that you're going to take your readers through. And, you know, it's all about disillusionment and you map it all out. And then you're like, holy crap, Amanda.
Yeah. It was, I actually still have, I have all of those sheets with the post-it notes and stuff. I've picked it up a few times and gone, should I just get rid of this? And I'm like, no, I'm going to just put it away. I can't bring myself to get rid of it because it was such a turning point for me when I started looking at how it all laid out in terms of my journey and my process and how, you know, it is my, you know, my whole process was me coming back to God in a way that was real. And I had like read through Lamentations a lot, like when I was sick, and the book, you know, the book of Job, because I seemed to identify with Job because, you know, he was like, you know, God, just take me now. And his friends are like, you did this to yourself, you know, and God's like, just settle down, you know, just listen up. And reading through the book of Lamentations, where it was just the laments of like, God, why me? And it really laid out the whole book as we were looking at the post-it notes. I was writing a lamentation, like I was lamenting to God in the process. And there was Lamentations 3, where it just literally was that lamentation. And so we use that through the whole process of looking at disillusionment in a sense of a lamentation, but a crying out to God still, and having to go through that with the post-it notes and not realizing that's what was happening. And then standing back and going, oh, my gosh.
Like, of course you're writing a book about disillusionment. And it follows the exact frame of a lamentation.
Yeah.
That you were just studying.
Yeah.
Before you came to the retreat. Like,
yeah.
You really can't.
One that was so powerful to me, mm-hmm. and I identified so deeply with, and, you know, I'm sure God was just like, oh, you're so funny. Cause I've just been like laying this out for you and you didn't even know it. And so, yeah, it was the process of laying out the book itself and seeing how it all fit together. And I'm sure that it was obvious to other people, but it wasn't to me. And it was like this aha moment of like, oh, and so this is why I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. And that was just like this powerful moment of touching into a part of God I don't think that I touched into before. Mm-hmm. And that was just this moment of like, whoa.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So you kind of hurried into the first few chapters, right? Like, I mean, one of the first things is when we're getting into this process, we're really trying to figure out like, how is this book going to be the most powerful? So people come with different levels of expectations, let's say, around what goes in there. Right? Like, I'm going to tell this much of my story. I'm going to tell this much, this much lesson, or I'm going to fill this thing with academic research or Bible studies, right? Like, you come with this frame, but then there's something that happens as you're writing, especially as you start to realize like, oh, the story thing is kind of important, where Marlia's, her natural story writing chops are so phenomenal that she would tell the story so powerfully. And then her pastor would show up and be like, and this is what it's all about. Yeah. And I'm telling you, it was like cold water on my face whenever I would get to that part, because I was like in the hot tub with you. Like, yes, I've had that moment of just being like, you have to answer to this. Like, what is going on? And then it was like watching that part of you that was still trying to say, like, how do you say that? Like, make it okay. Mm-hmm. Like, and explain it instead of just like sitting in the, like, I'm freaking pissed. Like, yeah. I am really, really mad, and allowing yourself to be there. But you wrote through the first few chapters and we realized very quickly, it was a consensus. Like, you have to stick with the story. We cannot yeah. move out of story into teacher, because it was too dramatic of a switch for yeah. the reader. And then, like, when did you feel it kind of screeching to a halt?
Which part screeching to the halt? The story, my the life, writing. The
writing. Well, yeah, I mean, there was, okay, so let's back that up, right? You're like, okay, I'm willing to consider, because now I see, like, I see the matrix, right? Like, mm-hmm. I see the message matrix. I see that my life is lamentation, all makes sense. I'm writing my own story. And then you go home and the story kind of hits the fan in your world, right? Like, it was pretty much right after that retreat.
Yeah. You may have to help me remember a little bit, because it's a little foggy for me.
A decade ago, girl. A decade.
Well, and here's the thing too, is that, there's a lot that was happening right around then. Just in the sense of, are you talking about like us selling our business and all of that?
I felt like every phone call I got from you was a loss.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So they, within a very short time of leaving the retreat, I had written through the first couple of chapters and it was old story. And so it was hard to process through, because it was addressing a lot of those things. And like you said, I was trying to flip into teacher mode, because my fear in a lot of it was that as I was writing about my disillusionment, I would actually stir up other people's disillusionment with my story. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to kind of go, okay, but then there's this part, like, here's God over here. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so there was that fear, but then I started getting into current and realizing that God was like, and here's more story for you, because we had built a company from the ground up, and it was pretty successful, and it was, you know, carrying us through. And so we were kind of in the middle of that. And while we were in the middle of that, and there's more to that in just a second, my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. And so we were walking that process out with him. And just before my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer, my mother-in-law, who I'm very close with both my parents and my husband's parents, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so we're watching both of them walk this process of trying to do all of these things to attain health. And ultimately, within a 5-month period of time, my dad died from lung cancer, or my mother-in-law died from breast cancer. Actually, we're coming up on her tenure in the next few days. And then my dad passed away from lung cancer 5 months later. And in the middle of all of that, I started on dialysis because my kidneys had failed because of the autoimmune disease that I have. And in the middle of that, the business that we had had for, I don't know, almost 10 years, I think, we ended up having to sell because there was so much happening with me and the dialysis and all of this kind of stuff. And we were at the point of needing to expand, and we couldn't expand with our current capacity. And so we made the decision to sell a company. And so within a 6-month period of time, my mother-in-law died, I started dialysis, my dad died of lung cancer, and we sold the company. And it was just like the loss just hit and hit and hit and hit. And there was just so much in that period of time that I couldn't even sit to write, mm-hmm. because there was nothing that would come out. It was just completely stymied and stuck. And like, it felt like I was choking on it, mm-hmm. in a sense. Like I had that like visceral reaction that it was stuck here in my chest, and it was just, I was choking on it. And I remember calling, like you said, and every time I was calling, it was like, I can't move forward in this because I can't process the last thing because the next thing has happened. And so there was just this time period of almost like stagnation, mm-hmm. in the writing process, because I just couldn't put myself in the chair, right. to do it. And it was so overwhelming because I was still in the middle of trying to process old things when all of these new things were coming up, right. too. And that was, I think that was a hard realization that, you know, I'm trying to do this thing like of bringing my story to the world. And can I catch a break? And there was no break to catch in the middle of that, because it was just more story coming, mm-hmm. and more things for me to process and ultimately write about in that too.
Yeah. And from my perspective, you know, this was early on in my journey of helping authors,
yeah.
but, I'd already been through the process with Ruben. Right. He'd come to me in, I think it was 2009 or 2010. And he got into the process of telling how he was going to write a book about helping people to structure their business so that they can leave when needed. You know, they're going to like, they want to go on vacation or they get sick, right? Have the structure set. And we outline it all. And then I get the phone call that he's got cancer. And I'm like, first clue, right? Like he's creating the thing. He's created the thing that he needs for yeah. this time. And yeah. so you had to go like work the process. And so, you know, you hustle through the first few chapters because it like, as soon as we got you connected to yeah. that pain and that disillusionment, it was like, it was ready. Like it was ready to just come barfing out onto the page, and it was amazing.
Literally.
But yeah. then we get right up to chapter 3, which is really all about mourning.
Yeah.
And being and feeling like the pain of the loss instead of like, oh, but God, yeah. oh, but God, like the end of the story is, oh, but God. Well, yeah. yeah. But in the middle of the story,
yeah.
tears.
Yeah.
Fury.
So many. Yeah.
Right. Grief. Yeah. Like, yeah. so yeah. I just remember watching you, listening to you, you know, these phone calls, and you were still showing up at writing days as much as you could. And yeah. just thinking like, I mean, I wanted you to catch the break, but I was looking at it thinking, whoa, like this reminds me of when, you know, I mean, I just remember you being like, I'm taking so long. And I'm like,
yeah,
it took me 3 years to even get to the point where I could face my own stuff, like really face it head on.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, like, take as much time as you need, girl. Like, this is, you got to process this stuff. Like, to me, it was so, such a clear tie to what you were up to.
Right.
So, I mean, so we get to the point where you're like actually capable of grieving.
Yeah.
Like you get just enough of a quote unquote break from the constant. And I remember just trying to create enough safe space for you to feel comfortable with the tears because that armor was so real.
Yeah.
It was like, and you know, I mean, how many women are disillusioned out there and men too, right? Disillusioned. And like, but putting up the face because like, I'm taking care of a family. I can't fall apart. What happens to the rest of them if I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like,
oh yeah. Well, and I think too, you know, the crazy part is that, coming into the mourning chapter and living that out and coming, you know, going to the writing days and all that kind of stuff and sitting in the circle, and hearing everybody else talk about stuff. And I can remember looking across, you know, the circle at like Teddy and you and Yolanda and, you know, some of these different people that were there and just thinking to myself, like, how are they doing this? Like, how are they holding it together on some level while they're writing through this stuff? Because I had not, like, legitimately, I had not really like wept or sobbed in like 10 years. And that's how deep that armor was. Like I gave the sermon part at my mother-in-law's funeral and I didn't cry. And I did the sermon at my dad's funeral and did not cry at all. And even like, you know, some of these different things, I just didn't cry. And so to sit in the circle and to be in a place where I had to experience a literal come apart. Mm-hmm. Like I had to have that come apart in order to write it. Because like you said, in the middle of disillusionment, there has to be a mourning because you're letting go of these expectations. And so you're going to grieve what you thought was going to be, what you thought was going to happen in life, in a situation, in a relationship, in your spiritual walk, whatever it is, you have to grieve that out. I mean, even for me, I had to grieve the process because I came in thinking I'm going to get this book done in six months flat. Like no problem. Cause again, I was writing about other people's stuff. I don't have to process their stuff. I just have to write about it. And in reality, it took me longer than that. And so, and part of that was coming to grips with that in my perfectionism and my perfect idea of what it would look like, I had to do that. But in order to get words on the page, I had to feel them first. And I had to walk through, realizing that we're called to tears sometimes, because that's the only way that we can empathize. And for us to write in a way that is going to touch the reader, we have to know what that feels like. And if we're pent up, like I was totally blocked and like, oh yeah, I can write the words and I can make them pretty. But if I don't have the emotion or the experience behind it, and especially getting to the mourning chapter, I had to mourn and mourn the loss of what I thought my life was going to look like, you know, mourn the loss of parents, mourn the loss of livelihood, mourn the loss of, you know, ministry, what I thought I was going to be for the rest of my life, and having walked away from that and saying that I was never going to go back to church ministry again, ever. You know, my plan was to come out of this book with a business of speaking and traveling and, you know, doing all that stuff, you know, I mean, like, and so, yeah, there was a lot of mourning that had to take place. And that circle, it was a dirty circle sometimes because my mascara was flying, you know what I mean? Like just tissues and snot and, you know, the whole bit. And there was moments too, where, and this is where, you know, when we talk about the safety of true to intention and safety of the process that we walk, had I not felt like it was the safest of safe places, I never could have done that. I never would have had the ability, the capacity, the opportunity to do that ever. Mm-hmm. I think I've said before, it was like doing 20 years of therapy in 18 months. And that's really what it was. It was 20 years of therapy in 18 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, from where I was sitting, you know, it was incredible to see, like, I mean, just to know that you were experiencing it as like, what's wrong with me compared to all of them. And yet all of us in the circle, and I'm sure Teddy will agree, we're like, oh no, like, we're all in that mess of trying to be real about what is and trying to, like, that's one of the biggest things, right? Back to the perfectionism conversation, like, why, you know, perfect people don't cry. They're that's invulnerable. Right. They're strong. They get up and they preach, and then they don't even have to grieve. Like, that is how perfect they are. Mm-hmm. Like, no, we're human. But we've been operating as inhuman for so long, trying to hold ourselves to standards that are just inhumane.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but it's such a trap.
Yeah.
Because then we got all the stuff on the inside, but we can't show any of it outside. And so we just get further and further and further locked out from the people who not only, like, love us, right? Like, on an intimate level, but also, like, I mean, when you say, like, I wasn't going to do ministry, I'm like, well, thank God you weren't doing ministry then, because the worst thing that can happen is for you to help other people get freedom while you're feeling like,
yep,
you know, the girl in the hot tub,
yeah,
screaming totally. At God.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Well, and I mean, and that's not, that's not a true picture of God anyway.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not, God calls us to freedom. And so, like you said, how am I going to stand up there and call people to freedom? How am I going to engage in relationships in where I'm praying for their freedom, I'm praying for their healing or whatever, and I'm so bound up, I can't even acknowledge that I need it, right? Or I can't even acknowledge that at any given minute, if you just talk to me in a certain kind of way, I'm going to bust out crying. You know what I mean?
Or throat punch you.
Huh?
Or throat punch you.
Throat punch you. Because that was more of how it was coming out at that point in my life, was not so much the tears, but just, I'm going to get violent with you in the name of Jesus and throw punch you. So by the power of the Holy Ghost. So, you know what I mean? And so it was that whole just experience of, it was God's grace that I was not doing ministry, that I was not walking in the calling that he has put on my life, because I think it would not have just been damaging to me. It would have been damaging to other people, mm-hmm. because I could not have shown up in a way that God calls me to show up. You know what I mean? And to be real and authentic and here's the thing, in the mess of life, I still struggle to do that. And I have to remind myself, okay, you've got to walk into this room as real as possible, because that's the only way people are going to see Jesus. And that's what I struggled with then. And so, it was good that I was doing it.
And as we discovered through the process, like, there were certain beliefs that you had in place.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and so what was amazing about this, like, just this absolute perfect orchestration,
yeah,
was that we had a pastor, former pastor in the room, right, who had walked away from a very, I don't know, can we call it a cult? It was kind of an intense, you know, religious experience, that it was like, I don't believe this and this anymore, so I gotta go. And then, but then how do I know, like, if that's not God, then who is God outside of this experience that I had for the first decades of my life?
Yeah.
And so, you know, she'd been going through that for the last, what, like 20 years by this point, 10 or 20 years. And I had been in kind of the same boat of just like, there's a whole bunch of stuff I was taught that was super incorrect.
Yeah.
And the reason for a lot of my bondage, not the answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to witness you getting into the parts of your story where, like, those were being challenged, I'd love for you to share some of that with our audience. Cause, you know, when we write our stories, we get to face, like, the deep down beliefs. Like, do I really believe that? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that, I have, very clear memories of that, because I remember sitting in the circle and talking about, and I wrote about it in the book, but I remember talking about how I, you know, trying to struggle through why, the why of this, and having to struggle through other whys in my life of like, well, I must have done this, and so this is why this happened. And I can remember processing that out in the circle. And when we were up in Glen Ivy and sitting there and saying, well, it's because like I left the ministry. I abandoned my call and I left the ministry. And that must be why he's done this to me. Like, this is why I'm being punished. And I remember looking up and catching Teddy's eye, and she was just like almost like a dumbstruck, like, what? And the room was so like eerily silent. It was looking back, it was like this divine moment where like time stopped almost, like it felt like, and like the air got still.
That's when the matrix shattered, Marlia.
True story. It was like, from a spiritual perspective, it was where the Holy Spirit filled the room. And Teddy said to me, you realize that God didn't do this to you. And I was like, what? And she was like, God is good. And he does not punish his children this way. This is you, just life. It's just happened. And this is not God doing this to you. He loves you. And that kind of processing, that conversation coming out. Do you remember, Teddy, exactly?
Yes, I do. Because you had said, you had told the story about when God told you to slow down.
Yes.
And you didn't want to, and he kept repeating it, slow down.
Yes.
And so you were saying, so this is what happened to me because I didn't slow down.
Yeah.
He's punishing me because I didn't slow down.
Yeah.
And the language was so intense. I mean, I remember her saying, he broke me. Like,
he broke me.
It was like this violence that was part of it. And I just remember, like, I was so glad Teddy was there, because all my stuff was like right here.
Well, there's a backstory, if I can just tell it real quickly. Okay, so I was pastoring, and it had come to our attention that we had a lot of domestic violence going on in our church, and we didn't know how to help them. And so I started attending this year-long life skills program by Paul Heckstrom, who wrote the book Men and the Angry Men and the Women Who Love Them. And so there was a piece in there about domestic violence. Well, when they started explaining what abuse was, and they defined it as the use of actual or implied force to get somebody else, to get somebody to do what you want them to do. So the use of actual or implied force, and they started breaking down to what it was. I had that matrix shattering moment. Like I realized that I was employing as a pastor those tactics. And not only that, purporting God as using those kind of tactics. And I mean, that was what had set me free from the bondage of the religious belief system I was in. I had to get out of that, but getting out was only part of it because it was so ingrained in me. So here I had spent, because I had become an abusive person. I used those tactics to control my kids, to control my husband. And so I was living that out. I had given them all permission to call me on my stuff. I like shouted it from the hilltops, because anybody see me do this, stop me. You know, because it was just so much a part of me. So I was 10 years into doing that, or maybe 15. And when you started accusing God or explaining God as using abusive tactics, I think the whole room kind of did it. Amanda did it.
We all had.
I was like, you know, the revelation. I said, Marlia, God is our salvation. That's who he is. And he's always seeking to save us. He speaks to save us from ourselves, from our situations. And when he said, slow down, Marlia, are you listening? Slow down. What if he was trying to save you?
Yes.
What if he knew what was coming in your body? And he was saying, honey, slow down. Take it easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really where the good father, like, I remember hearing that and just shattering. Like, I think I melted into a puddle.
You did.
Because that was where it was like, oh my gosh, what if he, in that moment, wasn't telling me, like, you know, when he was telling me, all right, do you hear me? And it wasn't him saying, do you hear me? Because I'm going to punish you if you don't listen. It was just like Teddy said, do you hear me? Because I'm trying to give you the heads up. I'm trying to warn you that this is coming and you can't change it. It just is because you're, you know, weird genetics, and that he's trying to save me so that I can prepare. And it was just one of the most revolutionary things that I'd ever heard. Because in my mind, I couldn't fathom that that's what it would be because of previous thought processes and understandings possibly of who God was, and the idea that he was not punishing me because I had been a bad girl, but that he saw me as his daughter, and that the greatest, you know, one of the greatest acts of love he could do for me was to tell me ahead of time, this is what's coming, to prepare me. And it rocked me to the core, and it changed everything. It changed how I read scripture. It changed how I interacted with God on a personal level. It changed how I talked to my daughter and how the things that I said to my daughter, and not that it was harsh, but just like, I took out, you know, be a good girl, you know, and, you know, the punishing kind of, innuendos and those kinds of things, because realizing that, yes, there is consequences to our actions. And a lot of those are just natural consequences, right? God doesn't have to do anything because they just naturally play out. And yes, there are situations where, you know, God has right and wrongs, truths. But in that circumstance, it was not that he was a punishing father, but that he was my good daddy. And that was everything. It changed everything in that moment. And it changed how I wrote from then on.
Yeah. Yeah. Because as soon as, you know, we really see, like, okay, this is the belief system. This is the operating system at the core for how I engage the world. Then the next part is recognizing that it's us, it's our belief system. We have been operating according to this. And so I always laugh when people are like, I always think of you and tell your story to clients when they're like, I don't have my title, my subtitle yet. I'm like, it's okay. It's going to come. Like, it might be in chapter 4, chapter 5. This is what happened to Marlia. So we knew from the beginning that your book was going to be called Where's My White Picket Fence? Because that captured the disillusionment. But there was something that happened right after that God matrix shattered, that you started to see that there was another matrix at play, that it was time to kind of face and rewrite.
Yeah, there was so much going on, and I think that it just kind of snowballed into so many different things, having to be rewritten and having to be processed out and acknowledged that kind of wanting to kill the good girl. I think because she was just, to me, she was just so like, oh, she was so damaging, right. You know, and she was so like, I just want to get rid of her. And you're like, hold up.
Wait, because what you realized like through that whole thing was like this, the matrix that had been built for you was like, I have to be a good girl.
Yeah.
So that I can get good things from God. Cause if I'm bad, I get punished or broken.
Yeah.
But then once you got free of that, you started to see how you had developed this good girl voice.
Yeah.
Persona in your psyche that was like constantly on you and holding you to standards and, you know, not letting you breathe.
Yeah. I mean, she was suffocating and I was just like, it's time to choke it out, man. Like I'm just gonna be, you know, done with her because there was, I couldn't see a coexistence. Like I couldn't see how she could still be there and me walk in freedom, me progress, me get to the next stage, get to the, you know, get to the good part of stuff. And so I remember just like, I'm going to kill her off. I'm just going to kill her off. And we're going to write about that killing off and how to do that. And
Amanda, I figured out chapter 4. I got it.
Yeah. I'm going to kill her off.
And you're like, death of the good girl.
Pump those brakes, like pump the brakes on that one. And it was really about how do I embrace her? How do I embrace her? And how do I make it okay for her not to be good all the time? Or how do I make it be okay for her to not be perfect and to still function? And how do I love her in a way that heals her? And how do I do that in such a way that it's not just for me, but it's for anybody who hears my story, hears what I'm saying, reads what I write? How do I make that okay for my daughter to where she can embrace that too and not feel like she wants to kill off the good girl because the good girl has done so much in her mind damage to her spiritual walk, to her mental walk, her emotional, her relationships, all of those things. And to herself, like her true self. And it was such a hard process because it just seemed easier to just nix her. You know what I mean? It kind of like felt like a TV show when, you know, like somebody like who usually plays the part and then you watch it the next time, you're like, oh wait, that's not the right person. Like they just like killed him off and got rid of him, you know, whether it's the whole character, or just that person that played him and switched him out. And that in my mind was like, I could just switch her out. Like I could still look like myself, but I could just switch her out. And I had a hard time processing through how to integrate. I think that's the good word, is integrate her in such a way that she gets what she needs to where she doesn't have to feel like that all the time. And I mean, honestly, that's still a process, you know, because we always flip back into the things that even though they're chaotic and hurtful, there's still a comfort level because we know them. And so that's still processing, you know, there's still things like, I mean, to be dead honest, I'm in the middle of stuff where I'm trying to do more than what I should, but it's because I got to show up. I got to show up in the way that I think I need to show up and do all the things and be all the things. And I'm realizing I cannot do that because that's the good girl trying to rise up and take over. And she has a hard time. You know what I mean? Like she has a hard time knowing her spots and staying in her lane. And so,
well, and she got challenged almost as soon as we figured this out. Cause now we're like in the last 20% of the book, right? And you like, you have gotten so much clarity.
Yeah.
And then I did this crazy thing. Like I had this wild inspiration to have an event and you wanted to finish your book and be on stage. And so we just didn't have time. And so it was like, this perfect opportunity for you to have this experience with your good girl and be in negotiations without.
Yeah. I think I kind of went split personality for a little while because, I mean like legit, because I remember you starting to talk about that and everything in me wanted to play. like, I want to play and I want to be on the stage like a big girl, you know, like all the cool kids are going to be up on stage. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of it. And as I heard about it, I was like, could I, is it possible that I've taken this long to write this part of the book and I've got 3 chapters left? Could I write them in 3 weeks? You know, and that's kind of how it came down. I think it was like 6 weeks, wasn't it? It was like something stupid nuts. And I was like, I'm going to do it. And you're like, but you know, you don't have to. I was like, oh yes, I do. And you're like, but you don't. I'm like, this is not an option. Like I am gonna be up
on
that.
Girl activate.
Oh yeah. It was like, she's like, I understood the assignment and she showed up and she activated because, and it was a lot of days sitting at that desk going, oh, what have I done to myself? And yet, oh, I could do this. And it was literally like, I can remember my body feeling like go into mode, like we're go mode. And I can remember calling you and saying, oh, what if I don't finish it? But what if I don't finish it? And then I don't get to be there and I don't get to finish my book. And I'm going to be so sad because what if, and you're like, okay, but what if you don't finish? And I was like, that's not a possibility though. Like, that's not going to happen. You're like, but what if you don't? And I just remember thinking, okay, but what if I don't? And then we walked through that conversation of, I'm going to be super disappointed and I'm going to be so sad. And you're like, but you're not going to die. Like, you've already been there and done that. Like, you're not going to die from it, you know? And I was like, but it might feel like it. And you're like, but you're not. And it's okay. And me having to grapple with kind of that last bastion of good girl, you know, trying to be a part of this process and really trying to show up in a way that was crazy. Like, and literally, I remember having conversations with myself of like, I could do this. No, you can't. You could do this. But what if I don't? You could do this. You know, and I can remember Josh kind of going, are you okay in there? Like, because I feel like you're talking to things, people, something. What's happening? I'm like, I'm gonna finish the book. And I'm like wild-eyed, you know, and hopped up on coffee and no sleep. And that was some good writing, you know, on caffeine and no sleep, man. But I did it. Gold star for her. But it was hard. It was hard. But at the same time, I think that me working through that and having come to the reality that it wouldn't be the end of the world if I didn't finish it. Would I be disappointed? Sure. Would I be sad? Absolutely. Because I wanted to play with everybody too. But it wouldn't be the end of the world. Yeah. And there would be purpose in that too. And yet there was purpose in the rush.
As soon as we had that conversation and you were like, okay, okay, you're right. I will survive if I don't, and I'm still going to try. Like, yeah. But there was a certain amount of surrender and that's like the rest of it just flew out and it got done.
Yeah.
And then the next big upset was when you saw the number of pages.
I was like, really, for 150 pages, really all this for just 150 pages. And in my mind, I was like, that's not a real book. That's a pamphlet. You know, like, I just was like, that's a little booklet. That's not a book. Who's going to pay for that? And I had to kind of go through this whole like business undone, you know, of again, expectations of thinking it's got to at least be 200 pages to be considered like a real book.
Just another matrix.
Seriously, just another undoing of expectations and having the conversation with you of going, yeah, but you're writing this to women. You know, and guys have read it too, but you're writing this to women who probably don't have time or desire to go neck deep in a 250 page book. Like they want to read it and they want to get what they need out of it. And that's okay. And at first I was like, you're just telling me that it made me feel better.
No. And I, to this day, I remember calling Teddy and just being like laughing afterwards. Like, can you believe that she is freaking out over the size of this? Like, I understood it, but can you believe it based on, cause Teddy was reading it, you know, she was like another reader helping us to get it clean. Cause we were moving so fast. Yeah. And I'm like, this is one of the most powerful books I have ever read in my life. in 150 pages. Like, how, to me, you were a freaking superhero for accomplishing that in 150 pages, and you're having this whole come apart. And I'm just like, how do I help her to see?
Yeah. Part of that was because we cut out all the preaching.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 Well, yeah, because I had wanted all the questions at the end, and I still kind of want the questions at the end, but but wanting all the preachy parts,
yeah,
the justifying parts, the okay, but don't get disillusioned like me parts, you know, and yeah, well, as soon as we stripped that out and like the story kind of came to the creme at the top, yeah, it was short, and I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this, but yeah, it ultimately came out how it was supposed to, because like you said, it wasn't a book that it was, and it's, I've had people say since who have read it, oh my gosh, Marlee, I read this in a day, or I read this in 2 days. And there's a part of me that's like, oh, really? But, you know, again, that kind of like, cause it's not this epic, you know, like The Hobbit or something, you know? But at the same time, them saying, I needed it that way because I was reading it in short spurts or in between kids, or I read it sitting in car line, or, you know, I read it when my kids were asleep, kind of a thing. And then they would say, and it did this, and I can't believe this kind of stuff. And so, you know, in hindsight, it was 150 pages of what it needed to be. And so, so yeah, it's not bad. It's all good.
So we get to the end of this book process, and you are on stage. You've now like brought your family into the mix. Like now they're at the event. You're like putting your husband on blast about how he's the next one who gets to write the book. And
yeah, still working on that one.
Yeah, I know. Someday. But I mean, then you had this idea of the business. And so you finish the project and we're talking about business, and then what happens? Like, I mean, this is 9 years ago now.
Yeah.
9 years. This is, yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. The most honest answer I can give you. And here's why. I think that it was like the adrenaline, you know, like how you have this adrenaline rush and then your body's like, you know, you're like, I'm done. And that's what happened, because I started, I wrote the book and I was like, whew, now that's done, you know, and then trying to look into the business piece of it. I didn't know how, because I really struggled with the idea of marketing myself. And I didn't want to like seem like, oh, I've got a book, you know, kind of a thing. And I didn't want to come off as arrogant. I didn't want to come off as showy. I didn't want to come off as, oh, it's all about me. Because I think I still, even having processed through so much, I still was self-conscious. Some about the story, because there's like, oh my gosh, people are going to know all my business. But more so of like me having to say, so I wrote this book and you really should read it because it's good. You know, I had a hard time, really kind of promoting myself. And
this is, wait, people need to understand that you had spent years in marketing before this, like that business with your husband, like you were excellent at marketing. You knew unlike most of our clients, right? Like you knew exactly what to do.
I mean, I had taken other clients through other companies through like building out their target marketing, going through a whole like plan with them. And then I sit down to do my own. I'm like, I don't know what to do. And I think I just got stuck in that too, because and I started understanding some of the conversations that I would have across the table with people where they're like, but I feel so like, I don't know. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? You've got a great product. You've got fantastic stuff. We'll differentiate you from everybody else, and it's going to sell like hotcakes. And, you know, trying to have that like pump me up conversation with myself in the mirror. And I'm like, you are so crazy, girl, you know? And I couldn't pull it together. And I mean, I had several speaking opportunities that I did, and I was actually in the, before Zoom and before podcasts, there was like this online radio thing. And so I had like a radio show for a little bit, not with a great, you know, listenership, but I did it with a friend of mine. And so we did that. And, but it just was, it was a struggle to just kind of figure out, how do I do this in a way that doesn't feel like self funky, like self weird, you know what I'm saying? Like, where it didn't feel icky. I know that's so professional sounding and a very technical term. It's but it just
extremely accurate.
Yeah, it's, and I think that that's such a difficulty for a lot of people who are having to, in their books or in their speaking, in their coaching or whatever, is trying to figure out how to do it where it doesn't feel icky to not only them, but to the people who are trying to receive it. And so I just struggled with it. And so I sold some books and I did some, you know, some speaking engagements and some of those kinds of things, but it didn't build into the business that I was anticipating. I mean, like Josh and I had conversations of like, okay, so when you're traveling, when I'm traveling, you know, are we all going to go as a family? Am I just going to be here with the, you know, with Savannah, you know, how are we, I mean, we had this kind of conversations. I never got on a plane once. Okay. And I think the furthest I traveled was 2 hours. So not a problem. Like I was there and back by the time she was done with her nap. So, you know, it was never an issue. And so there was a little bit of like, with that. And yet, you know, God knew because he was moving me back into ministry and was healing a lot of that burnout and was healing a lot of that. And everything that I processed through in writing the book and everything that I have in the book and just the journey of it all. When I, you know, came back, I did what I like to call a soft launch back into ministry, where I wasn't technically employed by a church. So I had an easy out if I needed to, like, you know, exit stage right. When I was still working and volunteering a lot, I was seeing how being in ministry, not just doing ministry, but being ministry, right? Being the hands and feet of God had changed so drastically for me. Mm-hmm. And how I functioned in that and how, you know, as Teddy would say, how I be in that. It wasn't a doing anymore. It was a being. I was being what I had processed out. And I was being truly who God had called me to be. And it wasn't just a job anymore. It was a be. And so even though the business didn't work out how I thought it would, the being in ministry has been so much sweeter. And then moving from just a volunteer, you know, into more of an on-staff position has been amazing because it's healed mostly, you know, it's always mostly, it's still, you know, a process. It's still, you know, it's a layer. It's like Shrek says, you know, it's like an onion where you peel away the layers. And that really is how it is. It's a layering, a peeling of layers away. But so much of it is done and was done for me in the book writing process and in the journey of getting to the actual typing out the words, you know, and doing all of that. And so, yeah, the business didn't happen, but for me, something so much better did.
Yeah.
However, having said that, a business would be great.
Hey,
you know, I mean, it would.
Whoa! Hey, whoa. Wait a second. No, wait, don't skip over that.
We're not gonna skip over it, but I have to do this part too. Like, so part of what we established through this process of, you know, working through the book was like really getting real about how many losses you had actually suffered. Like,
yeah,
the loss of kidney function and of general health and vitality, right? Yeah. The loss of even being able to have more children because of the way the disease affected your system. The loss of business, the loss, like there were so many losses. And I remember at one point in one of our circles, where it was like the conversation broke open of, I wonder how this will all be restored. Right. Like how could this all be restored? If it, now that it's been grieved, maybe it can be restored.
And I think that that was one of the biggest pushes in the book. And one of the biggest things that I've learned in the process of that is that, you know, in there's scripture that says that he will restore and redeem all the things you lost, everything that the canker worm and that the locusts have stolen, he's going to restore to back to you. And I held on to that scripture through all of it and just said, God, I don't know what this is going to look like. I don't know what this restoration is going to look like, but I know that you've promised it in some form or fashion. And some of that restoration came through writing the book, right? Because it was the healing process. And some of that has come, you know, and being called back into ministry and functioning and being in ministry again and being ministry again. And the question of how does restoration play out with God? How does that work? Like in God's economy, what does that look like? Because it, again, it never looks like how we think it's going to look. And, you know, one of the big losses that we had was not being able to birth any more children, because I have an amazing daughter that is our biological child. And we were able to go through that, but then grieving, you know, and feeling like that had been stolen from us, and financial had been stolen from us, and my health had been stolen from us, and that all of these things that had been taken from us. And then to see how, I think honestly, the processing through the book opened up for me to say, okay, God, I am really okay. I will be submitted to the process of however this restoration comes and the length of time. And of course, in my humanist, I'm like, can I have it yesterday? You know, let's just be done. And, you know, and yet, walking through, you know, dialysis and that sustaining my life until I was able to get a kidney transplant 6 years ago, which was a restoration of health, because literally I went into the room, you know, jacked up and came out fully restored, like back to normalcy, like we had not had in years. And, you know, there was a healing that, but again, just saying, okay, so this is really the beginning of what the restoration looks like, and just dominoes started happening of God going, okay, so now that that's happened, now we're going to open this and this and this. And part of that for us was, having the opportunity to adopt our sons and, you know, being, placed with our first son, and he was 10 and a half months old, and just, oh man, I remember when we got the call and it was just, I couldn't stand up because it was, I was just in awe of God. Because of the process that we had kind of walked through in terms of the foster system up to that. We had had a little boy and we had, he was placed back, and just kind of walking through that grief and then getting the call for our son and just saying, God, thank you so much. And then having him, and 6 months later, getting the call that his little brother had been born. And so we were then able to be placed with his little brother, and then to walk through that adoption process and to spiritually process that concept of adoption and how we, how God calls us to that, you know, to have the spirit of adoption and how we are taken to him in adoption and walking through that. And then, and just even financial restoration happening and just experiencing all of those things in such a quick time. And still seeing that happen and process out and how, again, it didn't happen how we expected, but realizing that it is so good. It is so good because only God could have orchestrated this. Only God could have written this story. And, to be amazed at how it really started at the point of writing the book. Because I don't know that I would have been able or ready to be open to any of it had I not processed through so much of that in my story and the mess of the story and embracing the mess of the story. Because I'm going to tell you, you know, it's not all lollipops and rainbows. you know, raising, I'm 46 years old and I've got a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old and an 18-year-old. So there's, you know, there's a lot of stuff in that. You know, I think I even joked at the front end, you may hear my kids screaming in the background because they are. And so, but again, seeing all of that restoration that I wrote about in faith and in hope in the book come to fruition. And again, it's still rolling in because God is still writing the story, you know, and still walking us on a journey that we never could have anticipated, mm-hmm. never expected.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean, from where I sit, it's like you got comfortable with the real part that you get to write, like your response to what happens instead of, you know, hanging on to that idea or that dream or that identity or whatever it is. Like you're much quicker to just like, oh, I guess that wasn't it.
Yeah. Plot twist.
You know, and to not do that in a way of like, and yet God, you know, like you don't go back into that, like trying to fix it mode. You're just, you know, I watched you grieve that first little boy. And while, you know, we all sat around the table crying with you, there was a part of me that was celebrating that you were doing it in the moment.
Yes.
You were in it. Instead of like putting it off until appropriate time or until never, you know?
Yeah.
And, I just,
that was a huge point of growth for me because my natural go-to is I'll deal with it later. I'll just deal with it later. And then that means just never deal with it. You know, that's just what that means. That's just secret code for that. Let's be honest. But yeah. And still learning how to do that. But each time it gets quicker and quicker and quicker because it becomes more natural. And again, it doesn't mean that you still don't experience some disillusionment or some loss, you know, the pain of expectations not being met, but I process through it, like I said, quicker and with a greater level of grace for myself.
Mm-hmm. No more throat punching the good girl. No more plotting her demise.
No, not mostly. Mostly not. Yeah. No, I think that it is, like I said, it's a process. But I think, again, having experienced the realization of grace for her, for myself, and seeing that through God's eyes, that grace changed everything. Changed everything.
Yeah. So what is next for you? You have little ones at home. You're associate pastor. Do you have dreams about what's next? Or are you just kind of like in the moment?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. I think that life feels like it's moving really fast right now. And so a lot of it is, you know, just trying to focus on my boys, my girl, and trying to rather, you know, Josh and I say that we're in survival mode a lot. And so trying to learn how to not just be in survival mode, but be present to what's happening and to be okay with that. And so I think that that's part of it is learning how to parent, two little boys that are, you know, they are spunky and they have some different needs that we're learning through and we're learning about and learning how to parent, in the best way possible. I love church. I love the church. I love the Bride of Christ. And so I can't imagine not being in, church ministry in some form or fashion. I just makes my heart sing. And so I definitely see that and what that looks like, I'm not sure yet. Like, I don't know if, I love where I'm at right now. I love working with the team that I'm working with. I feel so, and I hate saying this hashtag blessed, cause that's just so cheesy. You know what I mean? But I feel really excited with the vision that we have. And so I definitely will be there for a while as long as God keeps me. But I mean, who knows, maybe he'll call me to lead a church someday. And all this I'll just take with me as, you know, part of my bag of tricks. But I think also to, I think looking for more opportunities to share my story, because it's funny, like after you write a book, and I think we've even had this conversation, after you've written your book and it's been some time, you've looked at it and had it in your closet for so long, like the actual books, you know, that it feels old story. And so it's like, oh, I'm just going to tell the story. But it's not old to everybody else. Right. And so, and it's not just that story that happened 10, 15 years ago, but it's like the unfolding of the continuous story. And so I think once we get the boys a little more settled and situated, that I could definitely, I think I could definitely pursue more like speaking opportunities and those kinds of things. Because I love to preach in church, but I think that there's something different too that happens when you're in a room of women and men, that when you all encounter that matrix change, that transformation in a room together. And I love that too. So I think that'll probably, I'll start probably pursuing that in the next couple of years a little bit more. And we're also looking at homeschooling our kids, which is crazy. So we'll see about that. Cause I'm telling you, I've never been one of those girls that's like, I'm going to homeschool my kids. I was like, you know, you're going to go to school. Go there. And so
look, you know, I had a teaching credential and I felt that way. I was like, this is not good for our relationship.
Yeah. And that's kind of how I've been a little bit. But we're looking at it, you know, cause mm-hmm. who knows? And so I don't know, we'll see. It's just, I think in all of it, it's just trying to go with the flow mm-hmm. and just taking it day by day. And, because otherwise I get too caught up in myself. And my good girl wants to rise up and my perfectionism wants to rise up. And so got to keep it at bay, man.
The part of your book, the phase, the what is, mm-hmm. I remember that was a big thing that came through there.
Yeah.
Like settling into the what is.
Yep.
And I think that you're living that right now. You know, just settle into the what is.
Yeah. Yeah, because I can't, I mean, you know, there's so many unknowns, you know, especially with our boys and stuff. And so I can't look too far because then I just get all messed up in expectations, you know? And so that, like you said, Teddy, the what is kind of where we're at right now. And it's a good place to be. It's a good place to be.
Yeah. Well, that feels like a wrap. I feel so grateful that this was a decade ago that you did all of this amazing work, and that we have been sister friends since and you've given me the opportunity to witness the restoration. It's been incredible.
So it has been an honor to be in this process with you guys. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, and we are going to rope you into some work at True to Intention, just so you know. Like, that's kind
of, we've decided.
Aaron already has the role and responsibility thing. Like, it's all figured out.
Oh, my. Sounds fun. I want to come play.
So how can people get a hold of your book?
I think it's still on Amazon. I mean, that just shows you like where I'm at, for real. I think it's on Amazon. I think I need to change it a little bit cause I put up a different version of it, but I think it's on Amazon for sure. They can also direct message me on Facebook or Instagram, and I can just mail it out to them directly. I can do that too. But
what's the full name of the book too? Cause I don't think we mentioned that.
Where's My White Picket Fence? When a Good Girl Doubts God. That's the full title that we finally came up with at the end. Yeah.
Like, oh, shoot, that good girl. Woo.
Oh, she got in there, didn't she?
She did.
Yeah.
She was in there. We finally saw her.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so that's good. That's probably the easiest way is on Amazon or just a direct message me.
Okay. And how do they direct message you?
I'm on Instagram at Marlia Cochran. And that's my handle. And then I think it's the same on Facebook, Marlia Cochran. See how professional I am? Come on. Just all not at all. My handle is both Marlia Cochran on Facebook and Instagram, and that's MarliaCochran. And I'll tell you that both my profiles are private because of our sons. We want to protect that. But you can direct message me, and I'm always up for conversations that way, for sure.
Perfect.
See, I don't even have a business one yet. Like that.
I mean, maybe this.
But she said yet.
Yeah, maybe. She did. She said yet. I heard it. I heard it.
Come on, Erin. Come on, you can't pick up on all the little things.
Pam. Oh, you know that's so like bad. What we do here, right? Like
I know. Okay, I know.
We're doulas.
You know who raised me, man?
That's right.
Apple tree.
That's right.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone who's been listening in and watching today to this episode of Sips of Story Insanity. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, and maybe even sharing your own like super disillusioned moment. I think the more we tell those stories, the more possibilities for healing actually open up. You can also find more details about our upcoming collaborative book. You've got to read the full story of Marlia's restoration process. You just heard a smidge of it here today. And you can't make this story up. What if it's all happening for us at true2intention.com? So that's it for today.
Oh. We need to have her back so we can talk about how she went from lamentation to lamination, because we didn't get to that today, unfortunately.
Lamination. He's already got the whole business.
It's been there for a year. We talked about that.
Not gone. Erin is amazing.
So quick.
It's the next book. He's already been sending me texts with like titles. What did you say? This episode should be called Shouting from the Hilltops and Hot Tubs.
Teddy said hilltops, you said hot tubs.
Look at him. He's like, I'm done. I got it.
Mm-hmm. He's got it all figured out. He'll just create the plan and then you just show up and be the face of it.
I would love that. Don't make me do any work. I'll just talk. That'd be fantastic. Oh, man. Yeah. Always fun.
It is.
Always fun. We forgot our chocolate, though. Talk on it.
Dang it. What were you thinking?
I don't know. Next time.
Okay.